I guess what I want to say, first of all, is we haven't actually set the problem out. That most of you are aware, I suppose, that people with intellectual disabilities didn't used to live until old age. In the 1920s, the average age of death for somebody with an intellectual disability was about 18 or 20. So there's a growing issue about the increased longevity of people with intellectual disabilities. People with mild intellectual disabilities now have a life expectancy that is similar to the rest of the population, which is something that we should be celebrating, that they've got all these extra years, and we need to make sure that they have a really good quality of life in those extra years. People with moderate and profound severe intellectual disabilities still have a shortened life expectancy. That means that in overall terms, there's a relatively small number of people who are older with intellectual disabilities compared to the rest of the population of people with intellectual disabilities and compared to the general population. So the people that are here and us, we think this is a really big problem because it's a new problem for this group of people. The rest of the world hasn't really realised that it's a really pressing problem because it's still a very small group. And I should say, I think, that I started doing work in this area when I did my master's degree, which was quite a long time ago. And at that time, there was almost no literature in this area, and I came to the conclusion that there was a policy vacuum and that we had really unprepared systems to think about people who are ageing with intellectual disability. Somebody else came to that conclusion in 1993, and I came to that conclusion again in 2010. We haven't moved on. We've been identifying that this is a problem for a long time, and government systems, health systems, haven't responded to this issue. And those of you who are service providers are well aware that there is no resolution around which level of government has responsibility for the issue of people who are ageing with a disability. Who should take responsibility? And that usually comes down to who should bear the costs that go with that responsibility. And it's really problematic because disability is split between different levels of government. And so there's all sorts of issues about should it be the state responsible, should it be the federal government that's responsible, and how do we manage those interfaces between the ageing, the disability, and the healthcare system. In terms of the disability system, there's very, very few specific policies. We've had lots of ad hoc policies, we've had lots of pilot programs, particularly in relation to thinking about retirement for people, thinking about ageing in place, and thinking about dementia care. So we've got lots of bits and pieces, and there's lots of really good initiatives happening from the bottom up from the service providers, but there's no coherent policy to guide that development. The service system, as we're all aware, is very fragmented. It's fragmented by state, federal, but it's fragmented by accommodation and day programs, and never the two will meet very often. And that fragments people's lives, and that becomes much more of an issue when people want to retire. What happens when you want to stop going to the day program? You want to spend more time at home. What happens when you're in the group home and there's no staff there during the day because the funding doesn't allow for staff to be there during the day? We need to have a coherent policies around how do we bring those different systems together. There's an added issue that if you work in a supported employment service, that's funded by the Commonwealth. If you want to retire from that, you might want to attend a day program or get some support to be involved in meaningful activities in the community. However, that's funded by the state. And it's very hard to move from one system to the other at the moment. There's very little expertise about ageing and issues associated with ageing within the disability system, within the staff who work in the system and the layers of management who work in the system. People are very, and we're sometimes, with some just cause, are very wary of aged care services and of letting go of the people from the disability system into the aged care system. So there's a lack of experience, a lack of knowledge and awareness about the aged care system from the perspective of people in disability services. From the perspective of the aged care system, there's some real problems for people with intellectual disabilities getting access into that service system. And Jenny's alluded to some of those. And one of the major ones is about age. As Jenny's just presented, people with Down syndrome, about half of those people will have dementia by the time they're in their mid-50s. What's the age limit for getting access into the aged care system? That's your barrier. This group of people is younger, but they need the same sorts of services that are being delivered to people in their 70s and 80s. So we've got a systematic barrier there. And people are also significantly disadvantaged by not having advocates, by not having family members often. By the time they get to be middle-aged or older, they've lost their primary advocates and they're dependent on staff to be those advocates for them within the system. As we've said, the staff in the disability system often don't have that knowledge and don't know how to navigate through an alien system. And there's lots of issues. I think Jenny's alluded to some more of those too, in terms of quality and the knowledge within the aged care system about people with intellectual disabilities. Most aged care workers, most psychiatrists, most geriatricians, all of those people don't know anything about people with intellectual disabilities. They know a lot about their specialisation around health, but they can't apply that to people with intellectual disabilities. And in terms of the health and the specialist healthcare system, there's barriers there. Trying to get into a CADM service, all of those services which are specialists around people who are getting older, there's an age barrier too. And there's lots of assumptions. Our research has shown that there's assumptions are made on behalf of the healthcare providers that if somebody's living in a group home, for instance, that the people in the group home know all about health issues. And so it's okay to discharge somebody from hospital because they've got those nice carers in the group home who will look after them. Except the carers in the group homes really don't have that expertise around the health system. So there's a whole gulf of understanding between the aged care, the disability, and the health service system that we need to think about. And there's also, finally, a lack of decision-making protocols around those systems' interfaces. Some of the research that we've been doing has been looking at the circumstances in which people move from a group home into residential aged care. And it's really clear that the way those decisions are made are very rushed and that staff members, family members, and obviously the people themselves are incredibly bewildered about who has the right to make those decisions. And we see lots of quite inappropriate decisions being made by inappropriate people. So the current outcomes for people who are ageing with an intellectual disability aren't particularly good. I think we've forgotten completely about middle age for people with intellectual disabilities. Most of us in the room would think ourselves as being middle-aged. We wouldn't really think about ourselves as being older. But we tend to think about people with intellectual disabilities as being young adults or older. And we've made middle-age an issue about older carers. How can we support older carers? But we haven't thought about how can we make middle-age a time of real opportunity and development, midlife changes for people with intellectual disabilities. Being retiring from whatever you're doing, whether it's been a day program or supported employment, is a very risky proposition. People generally may say they want to not go full time or they want to have a more relaxed lifestyle, but they see retirement as being pretty risky because there's not much to replace it and they're likely to lose contact with the people that they've had social contact with for much of their lives. We haven't got anything substantial to support people to have a retired lifestyle, to support them to be included in the community. There's very limited opportunities and visions about what retirement might look like. There's a real disconnection between the policy aspirations that we have for earlier parts of the life course, that people with disabilities will be included and will participate in the society. We don't tend to transfer those to older people with intellectual disability. We have much lower expectations of that group of people. There's a lot relatively of older people with intellectual disabilities in their 50s and early 60s that are misplaced in residential care. Almost a third of the residential care facilities in Victoria have at least one person with an intellectual disability, and those people are generally younger than all the other residents and they stay there for much longer, and they're there because there's no other option. So we've got a group of people who really shouldn't be in aged care services but are. There's lots of inequitous decisions made about moving people out of group homes. People are often moved on the basis of the degree of change. So if you've got low support needs, and as you get older, your support needs become higher, there's a much higher chance that you have to move. If you start off with high support needs, then you're okay, because you're generally in a house that's adapted to people with high support needs. we don't have the capacity in the system to respond to the type of change that happens to people as they age. So we tend to move them out and on. And I could go on. It's not a very good picture for people who are currently ageing. People find it very difficult to access appropriate healthcare, and we've talked about that. And people's social networks are reduced as they age. And the chances are that people will have nobody outside the system who will act as their advocate and who will question what's happening for them. Most people have families when they're younger. As we know, families get older. Older parents are very anxious about who's going to continue to be the advocate for their middle-aged son or daughter. Often it's siblings that pick up that role, but if you don't have a sibling and the parents haven't done any of that groundwork, there's a higher proportion of people that get left with nobody to watch what's happening to them. So having painted that fairly dismal picture, let's think about what the future might look like in a new world of the NDIS and some changed foundations for thinking about people who are ageing. The NDIS, as you all know, is on the books. It's in Parliament. It's at the committee stage. And the Productivity Commission gave a really good blueprint of what the NDIS might do. It will give people an entitlement for the first time to reasonable and necessary support. There won't be any more waiting lists and there won't be any more rationing for the people who are eligible. It will give people the chance to plan for adulthood. It will give them some certainty in their lives. So hopefully people will be able to say, well, actually, I don't want to live with my parents until I'm in my 50s. I want to move out. I want to live with myself, with a partner, with my friends, when I'm in my 20s or my 30s. So we may solve some of those long-term problems about support for older carers. It will give people a lifelong approach to thinking about their support. Hopefully with early intervention and with good support when people are younger, we will be able to optimise people's potential for development and social inclusion. So people will need less support because they will have developed their potential. It will be a proactive system, so it will no longer be reactive to the crises that are happening. It will be able to predict and plan. It will provide individualised packages for people, so there will be consumer choice and hopefully consumer control over the type of services that people will get and how they're delivered. People will be able to manage their own money, or they'll be able to give it to providers and ask them to manage it for them. It will be person-centred. It will be flexible. They should be, over time, more diverse support models, so there'll be less people hopefully living in shared living situations. And one would hope in the next 10 years there would be nobody living in large institutions anywhere in Victoria or in New South Wales or across Australia. There will be case management and there will be help for people to manage the interface between NDIS services and other systems. So if this comes off, and there's a good chance that it will, in the long term, people will be ageing from a much less disadvantaged position. Hopefully people will be leading much healthier, much more included lives. So in the long run, people won't be as disadvantaged as they move into ageing. And if this system works, it will be much easier to adapt support to the changed health and mobility needs and people's different preferences as they get older. There was specific attention to people who are ageing with a disability in the Productivity Commission report, which is the blueprint for the NDIS, and there is specific attention to them in the draft legislation. The aim is clearly, from that material, is to ensure the continuity of care for people with disabilities as they age and to allow them to choose the services from providers that they want to choose and to be supported by the system that best meets their needs. That means that there will be potential to buy extra or different types of support to support people to age in place and to purchase aged care expertise as well as the disability support services that somebody might need. This is a quote, I'm not going to read it out, which came from the Productivity Commission report, and it said, it may be appropriate for people to remain in the disability system if that's the best place for them to be. And the tab, once they're over 65, would be picked up invisibly behind the scenes by the aged care system. Or it may be appropriate, if somebody is in late stage dementia, for instance, that they may move to the disability, to the residential aged care system, where they can get 24-hour really good nursing care support. So there's a sense that people will be able to use whichever system is most appropriate to them, and they won't be forced to move from one system to another, and it won't be difficult to change and adapt the type of support that people will get. So it's really clear, and it's in the draft legislation too, that people can continue to be a participant. If you're in the NDIS when you get older, that you can stay there until you enter a residential aged care service or you need 24-hour community care on a permanent basis. And when they talk about community care, they mean community care that's provided under the legislation that labels it as being funded by the Commonwealth aged care system. So that's good. It's been thought about, it's been worked out how older people might be managed within the NDIS system. And there's some important things I think that the sector needs to think about in that we're going to have to grapple with over the next few years. There's a question about representation and decision making. Who's going to decide on what basis when it might be appropriate, when it might be most appropriate for somebody to move to residential aged care, or when community care might be more appropriate? Those are key decisions, and the chances are they'll be made by the NDIS system, and they'll develop over time expertise and principles for making those sorts of decisions. But they're important that we have some input into how those decisions are made. There's some considerations about moving between systems. If you look at the cost differential, and these are old figures because they're the only ones I could find, in 2005, the cost of living in a group home per head per year was $84,000. The cost of living in residential aged care was $44,000. And you think about how that plays out in terms of staff ratios and all those sorts of things, I know where I'd rather age in place. The quality of residential aged care is really good in terms of nursing care, but we know for people with intellectual disabilities it's not particularly good in terms of social inclusion, in terms of social relationships. And we know that residential aged care services are getting bigger and bigger. So the chances of being able to be socially included and to stay in touch with local communities will be reduced as they begin to serve larger and larger geographic areas. In New South Wales, they've built a 100-bed residential aged care service just for people with intellectual disabilities. You imagine the catchment area we would need if we went down that sort of track in Victoria. You'd be moving to Melbourne to get that sort of service. And it'd be much better to stay in Bendigo and go to the local residential aged care in your area. So the other question is the market going to provide? There's a sense in the NDIS that if we leave it to the market, people will be able to choose. You can take your money somewhere else if you're not getting the good type of service that you want. That's fine if you live in Melbourne. I think it's going to be problematic for people who live in rural and remote areas because there may only be one service to choose from. And will everybody be an informed consumer? People are going to need a lot of help to make decisions about where they spend their money and what they're going to do. There's a tendency from the research from the US, and Magnus was from Sweden was telling me that it's the same in Sweden. It's the people with really resourceful, loud, pushy parents that do the best out of individualised funding systems. So, but to leave that to one side, irrespective of what you might fare under the NDIS, in that system, when it comes in, there is still going to have to be reliance on mainstream services, particularly health, geriatric specialists, falls clinics, all of those health services, all of the other things that we rely on aren't going to be funded by the NDIS. It's really clear that the NDIS will only provide reasonable and necessary supports if they're not more appropriately funded or provided through other general systems of delivery. That means they're not going to provide health services. The Productivity Commission really envisaged that the NDIS would influence the other major service systems to be more responsive and accessible to people with intellectual disabilities. It's very clear the viability of the NDIS depends on the responsibility, the responsiveness of those other systems to people with intellectual disabilities. If those systems don't perform, then the NDIS isn't going to be viable because all the demands will be for specialist services. The more accessible and the more adapted the mainstream system is, the better health outcomes there will be and quality of care for people who are ageing, but the less stress there will be on the disability service system, which fits really neatly with disability policy. There's an argument, and I think you're probably all aware of it, that people with disabilities are disabled by mainstream society, by our social processes and our structures that don't take account of the people with intellectual disabilities and the way they are, the way that they're different from other people in an equal, in a neutral type of way. We exclude people by the way we organise our social structures. So mainstreaming is about paying attention to social structures and processes so that people with disabilities don't have to rely on special arrangements. They don't have to always be picked out as different. So we need to build the capacity and the specialist, we need to build the capacity within the mainstream system using specialist knowledge about people with intellectual disabilities to try and remove the obstacles to supporting them to be included in those mainstream services. But we've got to have motivation to do that, and we've got to have the resources to do that. And that people who are ageing with intellectual disability are actually only 0.4% of all people who are over 55. So that initiative to do that, building that capacity, has to come, I would suggest, to a large extent from the people who see people with intellectual disabilities as the most important people, which is from the disability sector. We've had a goal of building mainstream services for many, many years. It's been a goal of policy if you go back since the 1970s and before. But we often aren't very clear what we mean by mainstream services. And often mainstream services are quite specialist services. And I think we've talked about some of that already, that the aged care system, for instance, is seen as a mainstream service, but it actually only caters for older people. And within the aged care system and within the aged care health system, there's a lot of specialisation that goes on within that. So mainstream may be quite specialist. But mainstream also includes things like leisure centres, it includes businesses, it includes public places, it includes for-profit places and public places too, like parks. So when we're thinking about making the mainstream accessible to people with intellectual disabilities and supporting them to age, then we need to think about all of those various elements and making those things accessible and responsive to people. We also know that the mainstream can be pretty exclusionary too, and it's not always a positive experience being included in the mainstream. It may well fail to meet people's needs, and I think Jenny has talked about that, and Julian's talked about that too, the way in which the mainstream mental health services don't respond to the needs of people with intellectual disabilities. So we have to think about how do specialist services perhaps support the inclusion of individuals or develop the capacity of the mainstream. We've been trying to get the capacity of the mainstream developed since the 1970s, but we haven't paid a lot of attention to how we're going to do that and who's going to be responsible for it. We've had anti-discrimination legislation, which is a bit of a stick that we beat people with, which requires mainstream services to make reasonable adjustments. It has standards, it has action plans. We're going to have an accessible transport system in Victoria in the next 30 years. It's not a particularly powerful piece of legislation. It doesn't require you to make extra effort. It just requires you to make reasonable adjustments as long as it doesn't cost you too much. So there's a big out to that sort of legislation, and it's fairly weak. So that means that we have to think about how can we begin to develop, if the sticks aren't going to work, how can we develop models of collaboration that will develop that capacity within the mainstream service and see what works for people with intellectual disabilities. when you think about access to the mainstream, we've tended to think about physical access. It's tended to focus on the easy things. So a lot of the initiatives have been physical access, ramps and rails and lifts and Labradors, those sorts of things, rather than thinking about how can we make it cognitively accessible for people with intellectual disabilities? How can we improve the communication between the medical providers and the person with a disability or their carers, which will make those systems more responsive? There's some really good examples now about driving change in the mainstream. So in the UK, for instance, and Danielle asked earlier about examples from other places, there's been some real amazing developments in the UK around each hospital now having a hospital liaison nurse whose role it is to liaise between the hospital system, the person with a disability, and the disability system to bridge those gaps and that lack of knowledge. In Victoria, we have the CDDHV, which is educating medical students, and it's been doing that now for the last 10, 15 years. It's growing the knowledge within the future generations of doctors about intellectual disability. It's a long-term strategy, but it's trying to drive that change within the mainstream. And importantly, the specialist medicos that have been working in those sorts of services, like Julian and Jenny Jane Tracy, have also been doing significant advocacy about changing the system. So I'm not sure if people are aware, a couple of years ago, they managed to achieve some new Medicare items. They said the Medicare system is discriminating. It's not accessible to people with intellectual disabilities because the standard consultation is only something like 10 minutes. So they were able to advocate for a much longer consultation period to enable that system to adapt to the needs of people with intellectual disability. It takes longer to have a consultation with that group of people. So those are some of the examples in which we've tried, which the mainstream can become more accessible. But the interesting thing is that all of those things have been funded from the disability system into the mainstream. And one of the questions is, how are we going to fund those things in the future if we don't have funded disability services, if it's all on individualised basis of care? How are we going to drive that change? Who's responsible and who's going to bear the cost for driving that change? And if you look at some of the literature, it's not necessarily going to be the NDIS. The Productivity Commission was really clear that the NDIS can't pick up the slack in the mainstream service system. Otherwise, it would become overwhelmed and it would let government off the hook, the other departments of government. So the NDIS can't pick up the problems in the other systems. But it will be seen that it will have an important role in facilitating referrals to the mainstream and trying to negotiate access into mainstream services. So the question is, who's going to pay attention to the quality of what the mainstream delivers, and if it delivers at all, and where in the future is the repository of the specialist knowledge about intellectual disability? So just think in terms of where we might go to from here. Change is going to take time. The NDIS isn't going to happen tomorrow. There's 5 launch sites, and they're only going to cater for 26,000 people across Australia. And they're going to run for maybe 3 to 5 years. It's really not clear, and we don't know what's going to happen in the next election. It may all be canned, whatever. But there's hope on the horizon, but it's going to take a long time to come. So my question is, well, we need to think about the people that are aging now. So in the short term, I think the disability sector and the aged care sector and the health sector have to begin to get together. We have to be able to bridge some of the gaps and look between those two systems and identify what it is that's preventing access and responsiveness of those systems to each other. So we need to up the knowledge in the disability system about ageing, and we need to up the knowledge in the ageing system about disability and in the health system too. We need initiatives that are going to support inclusion in mainstream services, and we need the creation of specialists within the health system. Specialists in the mainstream who have the expertise and can resource their colleagues around the needs of people who are ageing with intellectual disability. We have one specialist in Victoria which is Jenny Tor. And she's the only person who's got the expertise really to diagnose dementia for people with intellectual disabilities. And she has a huge waiting list. We need a systematic way of getting more expertise within those other systems. We need to begin to adapt and resource the disability systems. So disability services need to begin to take responsibility and think, how as we as an organisation are we going to develop policies and our capacity to support people that are part of our service to age in place or to retire if they choose to? And we begin to need to have planned individual organisational responses and to develop and resource some partnerships and joint planning between these different sectors. There's lots of examples of doing it from the US, and it only works if you've got some resources to make it work. You can't run good partnerships just on goodwill. It helps, but it's often not enough. And in the long term, thinking about the NDIS, I think we need to put some energy into asking the questions and pushing, how is the NDIS going to leverage change in the mainstream? Who's going to take that responsibility? And should that be a responsibility of the NDIS to do that? Because if it doesn't do that, then the NDIS isn't going to be viable if we're putting all our demands onto them rather than onto the mainstream. And I think we need to have a clear set of commitment and principles to inform what we want for people who are ageing with intellectual disability. My voice is going to give out in a minute, so I'm not going to talk about them. You can see them up there. And then finally, I think what La Trobe is doing and what I think service providers are doing too is paying attention to the training and the education of health and human service professionals in disability, so that every single health professional, human service professional comes out of their degree knowing about intellectual disability, knowing about the issues for people who are ageing, but more broadly, knowing how to relate and support people with intellectual disabilities within whatever agency they go and work in. Knowing about disability is important not only if you work in disability services, but if you work in anywhere within the health and human service system. Thank you very much.